Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. Just a reminder, you can find these archive shows at veritasmedical.com and also on iTunes at You're the Cure. We've got a great guest today, a repeat guest, Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. He was we were honored to have him on our show. It's been 3 or 4 years probably. And I was honored to go out to Polyface Farms this summer with my family. So we are super excited to bring Joel into the show today to discuss regenerative agriculture and solutions to the potential upcoming food crisis. But real quick, guys, before we bring him on, I just want to remind people, as I have before, so a little broken record here, but we're under about a 120-year experiment of pharmaceutical-based symptom management of disease. Prior to the Rockefellers and Carnegies coming in the early 1900s and employing Abraham Flexner and quote-unquote education specialists to analyze all the medical curriculum in the country and then decide that we need to standardize everything to the allopathic model, meaning pharmaceutical-based symptomatic treatment only. And we shoved aside the thousands of years of healing modalities that worked with the body's ability to fix itself. God designed the body to keep blood pressure normal, blood sugar normal, acid levels in your stomach normal, not coming up to your esophagus and giving you acid reflux. The body knows how to do everything, knows how to regenerate itself, fix itself, and keep you humming right along. And previous to the allopathic pharmaceutical-based version of things, that's what healers did. Whether it was Native American medicine or ancient traditional Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine in India or homeopathic medication, herbalists, chiropractic, all of these healers worked with the body's innate and intelligently designed way of fixing itself. When you get a paper cut, the body knows how to put a clot on that paper cut so you don't bleed to death. But the body also knows how to not excessively clot when it's not supposed to, because you could die from excessive clotting. It's this fine, beautifully designed system. If we would just steward it, if we would just give the body what it needs and avoid what it doesn't, it takes care of itself. We kind of have to just get out of the way. And even more importantly, not bring too many man-made solutions, I'll put that in quotes, into the equation. Because typically man-made solutions have short-term benefit with long-term negative, horrendously negative consequences, which is why I would submit to people to consider that we have the worst health outcomes in the industrialized world. Why do we spend the most money, go to the doctor the most, take the most medications, and get the worst outcomes? Because we're short-sighted, focusing on short-term quick fixes without thinking about the long-term unintended consequences. And obviously, at the root of that is the love of money. And even deeper than that, I think that's been exposed this past 2 years with COVID is the love of power and control. And my opinion is when people do not have a kingdom mindset and don't believe in God and believe we just evolved out of pond scum from nothing and therefore we need to take dominion over other men and women, humans, we need to decide for people how they need to live and eat and breathe and do their health care and just... Heard the head of the WHO the other day propose a treaty for one world healthcare, basically, but also he slipped in there anything that could harm the earth or the animals would be under the authority of the WHO also. So COVID seems to have suddenly disappeared from the news and from the consciousness of at least the media and the leadership. So I'm concerned they may be moving on to the next part of the Great Reset, as Klaus Schwab has clearly laid out and has told us, has showed his cards. But a big piece of this Klaus Schwab, World Economic Forum, Bill Gates, elite mindset is the whole climate change topic. And then that leads us right into the agricultural business and trying to take over agriculture and potentially produce all our meat in a lab. And when I tell people, Joel Salatin told me, you could sequester all the carbon. Since the Industrial Revolution, In a number of a matter of years, I think, or we'll let Joel speak for himself, but there's a solution to get all this carbon back in the earth. If we steward things the right way and look to God's design, how does nature naturally do stuff? So that's why we're bringing Joel Salatin in today to talk about this and to give people understanding, give them hope, and give them also a warning and hopefully a call to action of, hey guys, it's time. Our back's against the wall and we need to make some moves here. And so here locally in West Texas, we're the hub of the agricultural world in Texas here. So there's a lot that could be done locally. So Joel Salatin calls him, this is from polyfacefarms.com. I'm reading from Joel's bio real quick. He calls himself a Christian libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. That's awesome. Others who like him call him the most famous farmer in the world, the high priest of the pasture, and the most eclectic thinker from Virginia since Thomas Jefferson. Those who don't like him call him a bioterrorist, Typhoid Mary, a charlatan, and starvation advocate. With a room full of debate trophies from high school and college days and 15 published books and a thriving multi-generational family farm, he draws on a lifetime of food and farming and fantasy to entertain and inspire audiences around the world. He's comfortable moving cows in a pasture as addressing CEOs in a Wall Street business conference. So Joel, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you, Ben. It's a real pleasure and honor to be with you again.
Well, thank you. And I just want to personally say thank you for opening up your farm this summer. My family and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Our tour with Heather, got to meet your son also. You were out that day. But what an amazing and inspiring visit that was for us. So thank you for being open to the public and so willing to educate and share all that you've learned.
Absolutely. We have a 24/7, 365 open door policy for anyone from anywhere in the world to come at any time unannounced. And that's our pledge to transparency. And it also helps us to keep us on our toes. And anybody's welcome anytime.
Well, that's awesome. And we thoroughly enjoyed it. I do want to just touch on your background a little bit specifically. And I think it was Heather on the tour told us when you first acquired that land, the organic matter content of that land, and then the rate of addition of organic matter to that land, if you would have just bought the land and left it alone and done nothing, you know, the natural process of bringing organic matter back to land versus stewarding it the way y'all have done it and how much organic matter you've added. But just give a little history for those that are new to the show and new to you and regenerative agriculture. You know, what does that mean? And specifically on your place, what have you seen with the techniques you've used?
Sure. So when we came in 1961, I was just a four-year-old at that time. This was the most eroded rock pile in the county. It was just gullies and rocks. In fact, there was so little soil, we didn't have enough soil to hold up electric fence stakes when Dad started experimenting with electric fence and moving the cows around. He actually poured concrete in, used car tires, and made kind of, you know, like volleyball stanchions, except, you know, obviously didn't need a volleyball net. It was just to hold electric fence stakes. We'd roll those out on the rocks and put an electric fence. And so, and early on, the organic matter was less than 1%. And today, here we are, you know, a little over half a century later, all those rocks are covered up with almost 12 inches of soil. We did not haul that soil in. Those big rock, kind of shale saucer-shaped, like they were like scabs, you know, on the earth, and they gradually just, like a wound on your hand with your skin. I mean, the soil is the earth's skin, and they literally did exactly like your skin on your hand when you have a wound and it starts healing from the outside, and the scab gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and finally, you know, that new skin finishes up and the scab falls off and you're good to go. That's exactly the way these big galls gradually, you know, healed here in the fields. They don't have 4 feet of soil on them like they did 500 years ago, but, you know, it's a start. And that's happened in my lifetime. We have another field that was a little more inaccessible, and we just let it go. We haven't done anything over there except, you know, let trees grow on it, and it's there. And it literally has not changed. I mean, it's changed a little, but it has not changed germanely since we've been here. But where we've actively managed, and we've run the animals across, and we've applied compost, and we've done that stewardship, we've got, you know, soil built up, and our organic matter has gone to a little over 8%. So that's a move from 1% to 8%. And agronomically, organic matter is absolutely the gauge of soil fertility. That's what feeds the biology in the soil, all the microbes, and it's also what gives the soil a spongy texture so that it can absorb water. Every 1% increase in organic matter increases the soil's water-holding capacity by 20,000 gallons per acre. So we've gone from 1 to a little over 8, so just say 1 to 8, that's 7. That 7 clicks times 20,000 is 140,000 gallons of water per acre that we can hold now that we could not hold back in 1961. That's critical for both extra water times when there's extra water, as well as for drought times. So that sponge is much stronger and much bigger. So, you know, those are dramatic. Those are really measurable, empirical, dramatic improvements that we've been able to see in a half a century.
Yeah, that's incredible. And the list of benefits, I mean, just retaining that much water, I think about out here in West Texas, we're in the middle of a water crisis and have been for a while, and it seems to be getting worse all the time. So just that aspect of it alone, but much less the bacteria, the biology in the soil, all the good critters, and our listeners know about the microbiome in our gut, but there's a microbiome in the soil, and the more diverse that is, the more beneficial it is for the health of the plant, the nutrient density of that plant, if we're going to eat it, or if an animal's eating it, the nutrient density, therefore, of the cow or the pig or whatever. So just there's untold beneficial, call them unintended consequences, I guess. They're not unintended. They're intended, but we just don't fully even realize all of them when you do it God's way, when you do it the way it was intended to do. And one thing I recently learned, Joel, maybe you could speak to, those bacteria in the soil, not only do they liberate nutrients for the plant, but they impact, they go through the plant. I forget who told me this or where I read it, but through the plant, get excreted even into the air, go up to the clouds and help seed the clouds and produce rain for that particular area. Can you speak to that?
Sure, that's exactly right. So Walter Yenny is probably the foremost, Dr. Walter Yenny is probably the foremost meteorologist, climate guy. He's based in Australia, and he takes an extremely opposing view to the climate change narrative. He doesn't disagree that there is climate change. I mean, you know, there is clearly climate change happening. I mean, you can see. I mean, I was up in Alaska a couple years ago on interstates that were, you know, that 40 years ago were glaciers. So, there's definitely the mastodons that are falling up in the Siberian permafrost, but realize that, you know, that those mastodons were not there when it was permafrost. They were there because there were, you know, pastures and grasslands up there in Siberia. So, you know, the fact is we just don't know a lot about the history, about the fluctuations of the planet. And it's almost like we've become too knowledgeable for our own good. But Walter Yenny. What he proposes, and there's an entire movement. You don't hear about it in the main media, obviously. But the basic pitch is, water vapor needs something to condense around. It can't condense on nothing. And so it condenses on bacteria that actually exudes from the leaves of plants. So when you have healthy, lush vegetation, you have all these exuding microbes that go up into the atmosphere and give the water vapor something to condense on. Obviously, that makes clouds. Clouds make rain, and the rain makes the plants more lush. And it's this wonderful, you know, replenishing cycle. Whereas when there isn't vegetation or less vegetation, then there's less condensation, fewer clouds, less rain, and you go into a desertification cycle. And so, his belief is that the planet warms and cools based on basically this condensation radiator. Think about it as a radiator in the sky, and where it actually occurs is based on the amount of vegetation in that area. So when you have large-scale tillage, overgrazing, when you denude the landscape either with tillage, monocrops without cover crops, overgrazing, which is a tremendous amount of it, then you reduce that vegetation. Well, what happens then is that the areas that are vegetated have to compensate for the areas that aren't vegetated. And so that's why, you know, we hear people say, you know, it's in wet areas are getting wetter and dry areas are getting drier. Well, it's because the one sets in a debilitating cycle that's compensated by the area that can still, you know, coalesce clouds. And so the planet's radiator gets concentrated in vegetated areas and abandons non-vegetated areas. So the whole premise of this water cycle is actually the climate cycle. The whole premise of that is that we need to revegetate the planet. And plenty of people are doing this. There are projects in China's deserts, projects in Lebanon by permaculturalists. There are projects all over the planet where people are revegetating. And what happens is, truly, even in something as small as 5 or 10 square miles, it's actually changing precipitation patterns, even on places as small as that. You can't do it on 1 acre, but you know, if you get a couple square miles, you get a little bit of mass, you can really affect the precipitation patterns.
Yeah, I was reading about a rancher just south of Texas in Mexico in the Chihuahuan Desert, and I think it was 1 million acres he has, and he gets some amount of annual rainfall, I forget how many inches, more than his neighbors on either side of him who are not doing these regenerative techniques and mob grazing type stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's incredible. So at the very, very minimum, putting a cover crop. So there's cotton farmers out here mostly. And I mean, there's ranchers too, that probably some overgraze, or a lot of them do. But as far as these cotton fields that we see for miles and miles and miles, once that cotton's plucked in December, it just sits there bare and empty dirt for six months or however long. So putting a cover crop would be the minimum thing to do.
Yeah. Millions and millions of acres. I mean, I was just up last week. I actually was up in Indiana doing a farm consult, and the neighbors were all, you know, soybeans and corn. And I mean, I walked out there in those fields, and I mean, they're just bare, eroding. The sheet erosion is dramatic, hard as rock. It's just heartbreaking. And so, you know, the tragedy here is that we know how to do this. We have the resources to do it. It doesn't take more money. But we've just been blessed with plenty for so long in our own cleverness that we haven't realized how devastating our agriculture is, our practices are on the ecology.
Yeah. Well, it just mirrors so much in my mind, because I have a different perspective on the United States healthcare, put that in quotes also, because it has nothing to do with health, really. But the healthcare system and what it's done, same thing, quick fix, the insurance will pay for your pharmaceutical. But now we're 100 years down the road of doing this, and it's starting to become obvious that that was a wrong choice, a wrong road to go down.
Yeah.
Real quick, this is more personal fascination on my part. When I was at your farm, and Heather walked us all around, showed us everything, it seemed to me like, and maybe she even said this, I don't remember exactly, but your technique where you put your cows in it in the winter under that lean-to, the barn, kind of you layer the corn and the straw or the hay and the manure, mm-hmm. and they pack it in, and then eventually at the end of the winter the pigs come in and root, just that whole system, and then you go put all that basically compost out on the land, as opposed to just go put a round bale out on the side of the hill and let the cows graze out in the field on the round bale, and you know, maybe move the round bale around every time. But because of the incline, you're in hilly country, so the erosion basically. But could you explain that process of what you do with your cows in the winter? I thought that was fascinating. And is it your opinion that's one of the most impactful things you've done on your place or near the top?
Yes, on all counts. So Dad and I got onto this back in the late 60s. So, you know, he was experimenting with electric fence. We were moving the cows, not daily, but you know, every 9 to 10 days at that time. We didn't have our full electric fence grid. We didn't have our water lines in or anything. But anyway, in the wintertime, we were feeding through this hay pile in the barn on a concrete floor. And we were cleaning out every week so it didn't, you know, because cows were dropping 50 pounds of goodies out their back end every day that's kind of sloppy, and we didn't want the cows to be all filthy. So every week we'd clean out the loafing area where they were there on the concrete, and take it out and spread it on the field. And what we started noticing was that what we spread pre-February 20, when spring came, you couldn't tell you'd put anything there. I mean, it was just the same as it was. What we spread after February 20, remember, we're spreading, you know, basically weekly. After February 20, that stuff in the spring green up, it looked like you'd painted the pastures green, and it grew, you know, three times better and was just vibrant. And we start, you know, well, what's the difference? Same stuff, same field, same place, same cows. One gives us a benefit and one doesn't. And the lights start going on, and we realize, well, when you feed dormant soil, the soil can't eat. You know, it's sleeping, it's hibernating for the winter, and so the soil can't metabolize. It doesn't matter that it's organic. It when it's sleeping, all those the actinomycetes and the mycelium, and all, they're all, you know, sleeping, and so they can't eat. And so we were simply losing, through leaching and vaporization, all the important nutrients that we were putting down. So we said, well, we've got to stop this. We can't afford that kind of wastage. It's too precious for that. And so how do we not spread in the winter? Well, we've got to start storing it inside. In situ, well, so how do we keep it inside without the cows getting all manure-y? Well, you know, carbon, chips, straw, leaves, you know, sawdust, to bed them down to create what we call a carbonaceous diaper. And so that required a little bit of modification of the structure, the hay gate, you know, different things. And so we were able to accommodate a four foot bedding pack buildup. So every couple of days we're just putting in some new carbon, and the cows, of course, they're heavy, they're tromping it out, and that whole pack starts to ferment because it's anaerobic. We add corn to it as we build it. The cows tromp all the corn into it and kind of, you know, knead it in, kind of kneading like dough. And in the spring, when the cows come out back out on grass, then we put in pigs. Pigs seek that fermented corn down in that anaerobic fermenting bedding pack. In seeking the corn, that pays their salary. They stir that bedding and oxygenate it and convert it from anaerobic to aerobic compost. And so The aerobic compost, of course, metabolizes the carbon, holds all the manure and urine, all the nutrients in molecular stability, suspension through the winter, and then the composting ties it down stable into the microbes that digested it. And so there's no loss of nutrients, and there's no odor when you spread it because it's stable. And then when the pigs are done, a month to 6 weeks later, we spread that compost out on the fields, and that's our fertility program. And so by letting pigs do that turning work, we're not using petroleum, we're not using machinery, and we're fully honoring the pigness of pigs, letting them be co-laborers in this great land healing ministry. Rather than just being bacon and pork chops, they're actually, meaningful partners with us, which is has spiritual and emotional connotations. And it completely changes the economics of large-scale material handling, because the pigs do all the work. We don't have to do any of it. We can go work, do other things, read a newspaper or whatever, while all that activity is going on in the barn, and the pigs don't need minimum wage or need their oil change. What a retirement program. When you're done with them, you eat them, So, it's a great symbiotic system. And that then compost, is what drives the organic matter, what feeds the soil with earthworms and moves the fertility forward. So that's the way the cycle works. And it's a beautiful thing. And, I just can't say enough positive about it.
Yeah. Well, that was my take home from the tour of your farm, was that looked to be like the most impactful and almost even the simplest thing too. Like you said, the pigs are doing all the work. So that was amazing. We're up against a break. That first half just flew by. When we come back from the break, I'm going to give Joel an opportunity to just speak his mind on it seems to be an ever increasing narrative. The mantra that animals are bad and we got to go plant-based, everything. I read about some school cafeteria recently that won't serve any meat products. And basically Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland, and he's got who knows what all his plans are. But this one world government plan of what do we do agriculturally to feed people versus God's way, kingdom mindset, letting nature do what it does so well. So when we get back from the break, we'll dive deeper into that. I'm again visiting with Joel Salatin. Y'all check him out, polyfacefarms.com. Is that the best place to follow you, Joel?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So y'all go check out polyfacefarms.com. We will be right back. I am Ben Edwards. You're The Cure. Okay. Dr. Ben Edwards here. We are back with Joel Salatin, Polyface Farms. You can check out his website, polyfacefarms.com, all the books, all the wisdom. I definitely encourage you all to go visit the farm. It was probably the highlight of our family trip last summer out east. We thoroughly enjoyed it. So some people say, Dr. Ben, why are you always so interested in agriculture? Well, my answer to that's number one, I've always just had a love for it. My granddad, he was a doctor, but he came from a farming family, and my wife's a ranching family, and we live in the middle of the agricultural world, but I do enjoy it. We have our own little piece of land, and we have goats and sheep, and try to do our own few little things here and there, but ultimately, it's because the type of medicine we practice, the body fixes itself, but we've got to rely on nutrition in part, as well as hydration and exercise, and most importantly, be at peace and not stressed out. But as so many great doctors I look up to, like Dr. Tom Cowan, he ends up in the garden, Dr. Cowan's garden, and Dr. Zach Bush with Farmer's Footprint, and so many of these integrative, functional, holistic doctors end up in the food space, and I probably will too one day, because it's so integral to our practice of medicine. The body needs nutrition. The body needs magnesium and copper and all these trace minerals, and we need the vitamins and nutrients that are found in food, and unfortunately the modern food lacks that, and that's why we have to supplement where we're deficient, and that's why we have some supplements for sale, But my goal is to shut down Veritas Medical and Veritas Market, or convert Veritas Market from supplement sales to actual food sales. And actually, we have a plan in the works that hopefully I can announce next month to do that very thing, with local producers having a place to sell their products through Veritas. But that's another story. My point is, for true health to come, we need nutrition. So that's the number one reason I would want to talk about regenerative ag and encourage local farmers to follow Joel Salatin and learn from him and others, and start making changes on their farms here locally, so we can get local grown, high quality, nutrient dense food. And that makes the body's job easier as far as healing itself, and therefore makes my job easier, and ultimately can reach my goal of closing our clinic, because there's no need for it. We're all healthy. We can all be out on the land growing our medicine. Let thy food be thy medicine, Hippocrates said. But now, also secondary to that, it's become clear that the folks who believe in one world government, and they've told us this, they're just being blatant about it. Now, the whole COVID experience really opened a lot of people's eyes, and my eyes even more so, that they're on full court press of moving right ahead with their plans. And a big part of that plan is using this climate change narrative and then using their solutions, quote unquote solutions. So, Joel, what say you to things like cows are bad and we need to eliminate animals, and meat's bad and we need to grow it in a lab, and we can't feed the world on Joel Salatin type farms alone, and, you know, this whole narrative that's out there. And I know we only have 30 minutes left in the show, but as best you can, try to break that down.
Sure. Well, let's take it just start with a piece here. Let's talk about that cows are bad. So when I see these documentaries about how bad cows are, I'm saying amen, amen. When I see, you know, the feedlots and the irrigated, you know, the aquifer depletion and the monocrops of corn and soybeans and all that, I'm saying amen, amen. But the solution is not elimination of the cow. Is to change the management. What people need to understand is that 500 years ago, North America grew way more nutrition than it does today. Now, people weren't eating all of that, but, you know, there were somewhere, we don't know, but let's just say 50 to 60 million bison at least, 2 million wolves, 200 million beavers, flocks of birds so big that Audubon sat under a tree and recorded in his diary he couldn't see the sun for 3 days for the flock of passenger pigeons that flew over. They're all extinct now. And so read the Lewis and Clark expeditions, read about the amount of nutrition that was here was more than we have today with chemical fertilizers, John Deere tractors, and factory farming. So it should give us all pause to realize that we've actually decreased the abundance rather than increased the abundance with, you know, modern techniques. And so there's nothing inherently, you know, damaging about the herbivore, but there is something damaging about the herbivore when you don't utilize the herbivore. A cow is an herbivore, like a bison, an elk. When you don't utilize the herbivore the way nature utilizes it. So how does nature utilize an herbivore? What's the protocol? The three M's are: they move, they don't stay in the same place. They mob up for predator protection. They don't spread out, you know, singularly across the landscape. And I can go into the nuances of why all these things are important. The movement's important to give pruning and rest, and pruning and rest cycles. The mobbing is important to create aggressive pruning, so they don't pick and choose as easily. That means they eat things in a more non-discriminatory manner. And then they're mowing. You know, they're not eating dead cows and chicken feathers and ho-ho cakes and you know, spoiled M&Ms. They're mowing, they're pruning vegetation that feeds their their stomachs, which are basically portable sauerkraut vats. You know, the herbivore is a fermentation tank that takes cellulitic structure and ferments it down to, you know, you and I can't do that. We are not fermenting. We're omnivores. And so the moving, the mobbing, and the mowing are the three M's of herbivores in nature. And in modern agriculture, we violate all three of those. If you only violate one, you turn the herbivore from an asset to a liability. And so the indictment of the herbivore livestock agriculture that we see is an indictment of mismanagement, which is certainly a true indictment. But the solution is to fix the management to mimic nature's protocols of moving, mobbing, mowing, rather than eliminate the herbivore. So that's kind of an opening salvo.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And so many documentaries out there. I have to spend time actually in my clinic talking to certain patients who've listened to some of these documentaries and gotten a one-sided point of view, and it's changed their mindset on things. And I'm with you. I agree 100% when I see a feedlot or the miles and miles and miles of grain crops to feed those cows. I'm opposed to that as well.
If I could just give a little analogy, it might be helpful. Imagine that you and I, Dr. Ben, imagine you and I are on Pluto. We look down at the Earth and say, that's an interesting looking planet down there. I wonder what their education system is like. And so we jump in our little flying saucer and we fly down to the world and to the Earth, and we land in, you know, the worst school district, run by the worst superintendent, and go visit the worst school with the worst principal and spend 2 days in the worst class of the worst students with the worst teacher. We look at this for 2 days. We go back to Pluto. They said, well, what'd you find? I said, man, they'd be a lot better off if it didn't have any education. And so, you know, that's kind of how we see right now with the livestock thing. The conclusion is it's so bad, let's just get rid of it, rather than, hey, you know, let's bring back the leverage, the ecological positives that the bison, the elk, the antelopes and the bighorn sheep and, you know, all that stuff that all that brought on the ecology prior to now.
Right. Yeah, and especially out here in West Texas, we're on the prairie, and it's been cultivated into cotton country. Trying to grow cotton in a desert is difficult to do. So I'm encouraged when folks turn back to grass farming, and specifically using those cows to manage that grass farming, as you do so well. So I encourage those local farmers to really consider this. The local ranchers consider this. Look into it. It's radically different than the way your granddad probably did it or your dad did it, but we're in radical times, and we need radical solutions. Yeah. Radical meaning just get back to God's original intent. So do you have any thoughts, Joel, on, you know, this whole COVID-19 stuff over the last couple of years and where it appears, you know, the whole world's in lockstep with these folks like Klaus Schwab who have proposed their solutions for moving forward with humanity. Do you have any, I know you're a commentator and a politician at times too, so I want to get your input on what you've seen and what your thoughts are on how the world's changed this past year or two.
Big picture, I would say that I've been very disappointed in the duplicity of people to swallow the kind of the orthodox line. I guess, you know, we've been, we're not the first culture in history that's run down an orthodoxy that was incorrect. That certainly happened before, but this time it seems even more global and more insidious in that we're talking about, vaccines and injecting stuff into your body and, you know, wearing masks and this whole, if you don't do what I say, your hand is hitting my nose. This is a real problem. Most of us think, hey, I want you to be free to do what you want to do as long as your hand doesn't hit my nose. But if my lack of buying in, participating in this narrative, if you think my hand is hitting your nose, that's a real social and spiritual and psychological problem, and I'm wrestling with it. Right, I don't know what all the answers are for that. Except that ultimately you and I are responsible for our own health, our own decisions, our own bodies. I get all that, but we wouldn't want somebody harming their child, for example. And so if you think that my actions are harming you, that's a hard discussion to have. And so I don't have all the answers, but I do think that the whole thing has been a catalyst for moving people to a fearful situation rather than a faith situation. And when people are fearful, you can kind of get them to do almost anything. And so, the fear is that, the fear of this thing, and you've got to do this, here's the protocol. What I would have liked to have seen was somebody like Dr. Fauci step to the microphone and say, hey, you know what, we're going to go forward in faith that we have all the mechanisms we need to, withstand this thing. And so for a month, I call on the whole country, let's devote our attention to building immunity. Let's see if we can build our immunity for a month. So let's see, the first thing we're going to do is, for a month, we're not going to drink any Coca-Cola, Mountain Dew, soft drinks, diet, pepper, whatever. We're going to get off of the sugary drinks. Number two, we're going to get out of fast food joints, and we're going to cook from scratch for a month. I mean, real unprocessed food. We're not going to eat, Cheerios for breakfast. We're going to actually eat, some pastured eggs and some sausage or something for breakfast. We're going to sleep 8 hours a night. We're going to drink half a gallon of water a day because we're all dehydrated. We're going to sweat for 20 minutes a day. Yeah, that's right, sweat. Work up a sweat. Get the body moving around. We're going to get out and get 20 minutes of sunlight a day. Vitamin D is a big deal. And to top it all off, we're all going to make a list of all the people that we hate, and we're going to forgive them. And can you imagine that recipe for immunological function? You imagine that trial for 1 month? It would completely change it would change everything, and we would move from making all our decisions based on fear to pivoting to making our decisions based on faith. Yes, faith. Let's go forward. Let's go forward boldly. Let's trust that the system, immunological system works. Let's leverage it. Let's be thankful for it. Let's be full of gratitude, and let's honor it and respect it and go forward in faith.
Now, Joel, who in the world makes money off that? That was awesome, because I've been preaching. I go do presentations and I have slides. And one of the slides, my favorite one to put up, is a formula that I'd actually forgotten. And one of my mentors, Dr. Lee Cowden, a great man, president of the Academy of Comprehensive Integrative Medicine, he reminded me early on when this pandemic broke out, said, Ben, don't forget that formula we learned in medical school. Disease equals virulence times viral number divided by host defenses. And his point was that numerator, virulence is how powerful the germ is, viral number, obviously, is the number of viruses, that you breathe in your nose. We don't have a whole lot of control over that numerator. But the denominator, host defenses, and everything you just laid out that you propose Fauci should have, how amazing it would have been if he did that, lay out all those things, how those would have increased that denominator, made it more powerful, your host defenses, your immune system. And when you increase that denominator, then that D equals D, death from disease, death from this infectious disease, that number goes way, way down when you get that big right. denominator. And everything he proposed, and not just him, all these policymakers, whether it be let's isolate ourselves and be lonely and socially distanced,
right,
let's put a
right,
mask
right.
on and increase our CO2 levels and decrease our O2 levels, and then this yep. shot that now is clear is causing immunodeficiency syndrome. Everything killed our host defenses that the policymakers recommended, and everything you just laid out would have been beautiful. So just that right there should be red flags going off and alarm bells going off in people's minds that something's up here. Why wouldn't they do what Joel just laid out?
Yeah, I forgot one part of my recipe. I knew I was, so what's that other one? I'm just doing this off the cuff. And one of my other little ingredients for that recipe was to only watch 1 hour of news a week, and instead trade your news watching for 5 hours of pure comedy. Just laugh your head off, laugh your heart out. Yeah. That's also a part of it. Is this formula that you gave, was that in medical school or was that somewhere else?
Yep, that was in medical school.
The
infectious disease.
I have never heard that
definition. Yeah, I'll email that to you, my slide anyways, because I love it. And it just highlights that very fact that you just laid out. Why wouldn't every public health official, from our local health official here on the local news every night, to the mayor, to the state health official that's advising
yeah.
Governor Abbott, all the way up to Fauci himself, why is this completely ignored? And, mm-hmm. Obviously I have a take on that we're under deception from the father of all lies himself. And it's just the way human beings are going to have to walk through this fire
right.
to try to wake them up. But obviously the love of money, power, like I mentioned at the top of the show, there's a lot at play here. And people need to recognize and learn to discern the schemes of the enemy. And we just haven't, many of us have not, I think, as a whole in our population, learned to discern these deeper things. We just can't believe someone would be, not have our best interest at heart.
Well, I'll push you just a little bit there. I find that questioning somebody's intentions it's a slippery slope, and often it doesn't move the conversation where it ought to go. So I even assume, I even assume Bill Gates is sincere. Now I think he's sincerely wrong, but I don't think he wants to hurt people. I mean, he may, but I don't. The point I'm making here is it doesn't help to assume Bill Gates is an evil person any more than it helps, to say Monsanto is an evil. No, you read their website. They're all about we're feeding the world. We're destroying hunger. I like to assume that the intents are well-meaning, and so then you don't get in a big debate about something nebulous. You actually get in a debate about action. You look at the fruit on the tree. Judge the tree by its fruit.
Yeah.
And what's it bearing? What's it doing?
Amen.
And in general, I find that I get farther, especially with people who are on the other side of the political spectrum or spiritual spectrum or whatever. I start with just assuming that you have, good intentions. Let's start there, and then let's look at the fruit.
Yeah, that is a great point, Joel. Thank you for bringing that out. And that kind of leads into my last question. We've got 8 minutes or so. Feeding the world. Monsanto feeds the world and clothes the world around here with cotton. We can't shift this huge agricultural system or we'd all starve. So from that standpoint of feeding the world, but even down to food security, with what's going on in Russia and Ukraine and, what's the wheat supply going to do, or fertilizer, and how's that going to impact? But local, could a local, these local farms around Lubbock, Texas, could we feed Lubbock County with just some local farmers? And can we feed the world by moving more to this regenerative type of farming? What say you on that topic? Because the answer I get from conventional guys around here who haven't even looked at the regenerative stuff is there's no way we can feed the world by doing it any other way than what we're doing.
Oh, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, I would suggest that the only way to actually feed the world is with a biologically oriented rather than a mechanically oriented food system. And that's a big statement right there. But our whole agricultural paradigm right now is fundamentally mechanical. That life is fundamentally mechanical, and the other side of that is the other idea is that life is fundamentally biological. That's what I espouse. Now, are there other physics and, you know, raw chemistry and things? And well, sure, absolutely. There's inanimate parts of that biology, but there's a big difference between a wheel bearing that goes out in your car and its ability to adapt, to heal, to find, you know, to find grease that it needs to get lubed up, versus, you know, a malfunctioning a pulled ligament or a pulled muscle or you know, something going on in your body. And so the difference between being able to heal is profound between, you know, a mechanical machine versus a plant or an animal. And so if you, I mean, I'll just give you a couple of numbers here on our farm here in Virginia. The average pasture in our county generates 80 cow days. In other words, it'll feed 80 cows, 80 cow days in a year. So it could either feed like 80 cows one day a year or one cow for 80 days a year. That's per acre. On our farm, we're averaging close to 400 cow days per acre. That's five times the county average. We've not bought a bag of chemical fertilizer. We haven't planted a seed in 60 years, and we started with a rock pile and gullies. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'd say that with my hands raised and honoring a creator's magnificent, amazing design that makes this work so synergistically, symbiotically, so beautifully. And so our mandate is not to adulterate, to override, to conquistador this womb that we've been bequeathed. It is to actually massage it, to caress it, to leverage the template with human creativity and come alongside as a partner. You know, imagine if all of our neighbors got five times more cow days per acre, and all their neighbors got, and all of Virginia got, and all, you know, you just spread that out, and the fact is that the abundance that is possible, you know, we can't even imagine today. The conventional farmer views nature as a reluctant partner that must be, you know, half Nelsoned and wrestled and you know, fought with, as opposed to a benevolent lover who just wants to be caressed in the right places. And that is a profound difference in worldview, in paradigm, and it affects then what we do and how we interact with this gift called creation.
Beautifully said. And I could just insert, you know, my profession, the medical profession, the way we try to half Nelson and wrestle with and subdue it with pharmaceuticals, subdue the symptoms. It's just such a correlation between medical and agriculture. And it's because it's all coming from the same creator. It's an amazing design if we just steward it and get in line with his original intent and design and plan. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. Well, that was awesome. The hour flew by. Joel, if people are hearing you for the first time and you've piqued their interest and maybe they're in the agricultural space here in West Texas and they want to learn more, what are some avenues to pursue as far as, you know, do you put on conferences, or is there a particular book out of your 15 books that you'd recommend, or or just come out to the farm and get educated, or what's the way forward, first step for someone to take that's new to this
game? Yeah, well, all the above, certainly our website, Polyface Farms, has lots of information, and it gives all of our educational seminars. It gives my speaking schedule where I'm traveling and speaking. I'll actually be in Texas in June or something, near Austin, doing a shindig. Yeah, actually May 15th in Buda, outside of Austin there. But anyway, I'm all around. And you're absolutely certainly welcome to come to the farm. We do, you know, we do tours, both private and the lunatic tours on hay wagons. Lots of gatherings. Dell Bigtree from Highwire will be here May the 7th on our first gathering of the summer. We'll do six of these gatherings. Some are dedicated to more, you know, financial. Some are health oriented. But anyway, we want to be a catalyst for healing. Personally and, you know, on the land and in all of its aspects. So, yes, we're glad to help and serve the best we can.
Well, thank you, Joel. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for the hour of your time. I know your time is precious, and I appreciate you giving up an hour for our audience. I know it's going to benefit a lot of folks out here. The ripple effect will be large. Thank you for what you do for the whole world, really. Man, for your little farm there too, and what an impact it's made. So y'all go check out Joel Salatin and everything he's doing at polyfacefarms.com is his website. Joel, thank you for being with us. We'll have to have you back again soon.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for being a leader.
Well, you're very welcome. Okay, everybody, it's been another show. Great show, great guests. We love to bring you these folks to benefit you and your life and your health and your family. So y'all share this with your friends and loved ones. VeritasMedical.com is where it'll be archived, or on iTunes at You're the Cure. Y'all come back next week and we'll have another great show. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. You're the Cure.